So Richard, just to start us off, would you mind just telling us really briefly about the experience that you had last April?
Okay, yes, I've been a work carer for my wife Sheila since April 1991 when she suffered some trauma at work and had a breakdown. She then went on through the series of years having lots of other physical illnesses, so she, in the end she was pretty poorly all the way on. And April of this year, she used to go in hospital two, three, four times a year, something like that, because respiratory issues, they used to have to sort of get her sorted out. But in April of this year, she collapsed at home, and when I went downstairs and found her, at the time I thought she was already dead, but I soon realised that I was hitting a situation that I didn't feel was going to end with a very good outcome.
So she went into hospital,
yeah.
And you're in the emergency room, and yeah. Do you want to tell us what happened then?
Yes, I went into the emergency room, and they were already trying to treat Sheila. And there were, at the time, there were three doctors, there was a matron, two sisters and two staff nurses, all busying themselves around her. And when I walked in, the doctor sort of asked me, one of the doctors asked me, said, "Are you her husband?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Can you tell me anything about her conditions?" And I said, "Well, I've been her carer for 25 years. Is that what you mean?" And he said, "Oh, yes, please." He said, "Can you just stand there, hold at the end of the bed, hold Sheila's feet, we'll work around you, just tell me everything you know." And this is what I proceeded to do. It felt as though it was ages, but it was probably 5-10 minutes, something like that. But the first thing I noticed is they hadn't got oxygen on her, and she was oxygen dependent. So we addressed that situation, and then they went on to treat her. He then told me that he didn't, at that point, he said, "I think we're fighting a difficult battle here that we may not get the outcome you desire." So he then sort of mentioned to me that an operation was going to be essential. And what I remember most out of that was the fact that he said, "I'd like you to sign the paper if you feel comfortable doing it. But if you don't worry. We have to operate, and it is a clinical decision. But if you sign it, it just tidies things up a bit." But he said, "Whatever the outcome, I never want you to think that you have contributed to Sheila, the situation that has ended up in however it's ended up." So that that was that. And as I say, they operated on her. It didn't have a good outcome, but she was then in critical care for 12 days.
So it had a very tragic outcome. Your wife Sheila died in April.
She did,
which is
yeah.
Really, really sad. But the conversations we've had about it, Richard, were that it was the quality of care that you received, the quality of the conversations that you had with the doctors and nurses whilst Sheila was in hospital and while you were there, and the way they treated you as a carer that made a difference. So what was, if you could kind of say, if you could kind of categorise the way that those staff treated you and how you could kind of spread that elsewhere in the NHS, what would be the sort of qualities or essential ingredients that you'd want to spread throughout the NHS so that other people had, had good experiences, even in sad situations?
Okay, well, as briefly as I can then, Catherine, what I would say is that while Sheila was being operated on, there was a staff nurse there that sort of said to me, "Richard, have you eaten today?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, look, there's a canteen. Will you go and have some food because you've got a long day ahead of you?" I just replied by saying, "I don't want to leave because they've said Sheila might only be 20 minutes and I must be here when she gets back." She said, "Fair enough." Off she trotted. Come back a few minutes later, one of those little trays that goes around the bed, and there was a pack of sandwiches, a pack of crisps, and I think it was a packet of biscuits. And there was a hot drink, can't remember if it was tea or coffee. She pulled it at the side, put a chair up, said, "Sit down and eat that." And then she got a chair and sat down the other side of me and said, "That's all right, I'm going to keep an eye on you because you need looking after as well." That continued. Sheila was back shortly, but she stayed in the A&E part for about 5 more hours before she was transferred to critical care. That nurse never left my side that I can remember in any of that time. She kept an eye on me all the way through. Then when she was transferred up to critical care, there was another nurse there that did exactly the same thing for the next 12 days, and a sister, and they were absolutely fabulous. And I've had some pretty rotten experiences for Sheila and being her carer over the last 25 years, but I'm so lucky to say that the very last one was the best of the lot, and it left such a lot of good, positive vibes.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah. So if you had three wishes, what would they be about how the NHS could adopt this listening, this being present, this compassion that Professor West talked about earlier? Right. What are your three wishes? He's written them down.
Yeah, well, I've had to write these down. For me, and I think it fits in so well with what you're doing, I mean, we're asking people to collaborate and communicate with each other, and so that we can make treatment better. But what you have to do to help us, as much as we're trying to help you, and that is those of you who are specialists, and when you've got patients that have got multi-conditions like Sheila had, and she had five specialists that she was under, they did not communicate with each other. The biggest problems I had out of that is Sheila was on so many drugs for the last 15 years of her life. On average, each month, I'd have between 3 and 5 days where I would have a Sheila that I could talk to, because the rest of the time she was either asleep or she was drugged up to the eyeballs and didn't know where she was, who she was, and what was happening. She could be pretty hard on me, you know, without realising it. And a lot of those things could have been avoided, so I've been led to believe, have these people collaborated better with the way they issued their drugs. The second one is more about what I've experienced in trying to get Sheila better help and adaptations and kind of things like that, the support services. When you have to have the equipment necessary to help you keep that person at home, the biggest problem we have, and I know dozens of carers that have had this issue where you are assessed and reassessed, passed from one place to another, and so many people, I've heard this story so many times of so many people that have got so fed up with it, they've said, oh, hell with it, and managed without. But those people have struggled, really struggled. I was one of those a little bit more forceful, and I did get, in the end, most things I wanted, but on one occasion there was a 4-year fight before I got a particular piece of equipment. So that would be my second one. The third one, if you don't mind, because for me it's the most important one from a carer's point of view, and that is to work with, I've got to take my glasses off because they're long distance ones, excuse me. The first one is, or rather it is, to work with and support the unpaid carers. They are your experts by experience. And I'd like you just to remember that every day there are 6,000 people who become carers added to the list that we've already got. Yes, you will get ones like me that have now dropped off the other end, but that is another question. These are the people who keep your patients from being bed blockers in either the hospitals or the care homes. And their continued good health is essential to a successful outcome. Please don't do what successive governments do, and that is to totally fail to recognise and support family carers. And finally, I would just sort of say, they are not part of any of your problems. They are one of the main solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Okay. Thanks, Richard. Thanks very much indeed. So I talked earlier about the three C's, the conversations, the communities. I'm going to be talking a little bit about co-production in a moment. In terms of addressing the challenge that you've got to create a movement for change around health coaching, to change the system, to work with communities and actually make a real difference and build on what's good that's going on already. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking that really we're talking about a complete paradigm shift, aren't we? We're talking about shifting away from what's the matter with you to what matters to you, whether it's in a one-to-one conversation, whether it's the clinicians talking to each other to make sure the care's joined up, whether it's a conversation with communities. And it means changing everything, doesn't it? It means the way we need to change the way that people are trained, what people expect from the NHS, what it means to receive services as well as give them, how we organise everything, and how the system works, how the system supports this way of working, how it incentivises the right things, and kind of we measure the right things rather than the things which are going to keep on having us do the same thing we've always done. And this green wavy line is something in the Coalition for Collaborative Care you might have seen. It's the person with a long-term condition is the green wavy line. And we talked quite a lot about improving the red lines, which is when they come into contact with services, but not to forget that actually the green wavy line is over 8,000 hours a year people caring for themselves. So it's quite a challenge to shift that thinking from we're not actually that important in services, it's actually the person themselves and what they deal with day to day is actually really, really important. So I just put this quote up. I was having a conversation earlier about Edgar Cayce. Has anyone heard of Edgar Cayce? So Edgar Cayce invented time banking that I was talking about earlier. So and the reason I put this quote up is because I think it really explains co-production. Sometimes people think co-production is just another sort of jargon term. But what Edgar Cayce was saying is that we don't have enough money anymore in the system, nor did we ever, to solve all of the really wicked issues, as they're sometimes called, the really, really difficult things that we need to solve in our society, you know, and how we actually really do the job of some of the really, really important things in our society, raising children, keeping a neighbourhood safe. It's not just about services. The only way we can do it is to stop thinking about people as patients or clients or even customers, but actually think of people as co-workers in creating a better society together. So it's an American term, co-workers, but I think it takes us to co-production, which is why I like that quote. And the New Economics Foundation, you know, 6 years ago now, is talking about equal and reciprocal arrangements between public services and people. So it's actually a completely different way of viewing public service, and not just health, social care, and way beyond that. People-powered health, I've spoken about the three different levels of people-powered health there. And there is lots of evidence around co-production being really, really valuable as well. So this is care and support planning in a practice that Cabinet Office report from 6 years ago suggest that practices could save money if they adopted care and support planning. So that's actually working with people on a one-to-one level to ask what matters to you instead of the way that things normally work. Just to flag up this tool, the Coalition for Collaborative Care, in partnership with many others, has created this one page of what co-production is and how you do it. So it's a set of values and behaviours or things that you can do to make co-production a reality. So I wanted to flag that up. It's a useful resource, and maybe we can make sure we link to it from the website, Penny. So this is about the strategic level of co-production, how you kind of set up a group of people who kind of can be your guiding coalition, really, part of your guiding coalition to bring lived experience in. But I was thinking about, well, you know, what is the challenge? How do we do this? And I was thinking about what knowledge, experience and skills might be in this room that is going to help you grow this movement for change. I have no doubt that many of you know how to make things happen and have had many conversations about how you make things happen from, you know, Penny's, you know, real passion around this. You've created this huge movement, Penny, and it's kind of almost, we're almost at the start, but actually there was a start way back when it was conversations that got you to this place. So I guess it's about everybody having those conversations back where you are and using the skills that you've got within your teams to kind of make this movement happen. This is a graphic drawn for Skills for Care, another one of our partners, showing the skills in a community. So a little bit like when a time bank might have a conversation with people in the community about what they can offer. Why don't you have a conversation with people in your teams and communities about how you can grow this movement for change? Because you will, I'm sure, throw up amazing results from that. But I just wanted to share with you a little bit about network theory. So, and this kind of brings it to life a little bit. So you can see I've ruthlessly stolen this slide from the RSA as well. I'd like to point out the Centre for Citizenship and Community is one of our partners, so I think I'm kind of allowed. This is about how networks can make things happen. And the study of network theory is multidisciplinary, so it's about how diseases might spread, how fungi grow, it's computer science, as well as society and social networks. So just to illustrate this, I just want to ask you a question. Is curly hair contagious? No? Well, the answer is it was in the 80s. Because it was fashionable and people started to get perms, so more people got a perm. And then everybody had curly hair. Hands up who had a perm in the 80s. See? And then everyone went super straight in the 90s. You know, hands up who went super straight in the 90s. You bought hair straightener, GHD, yes, there you go. So one of the rules of networks is that birds of a feather stick together. So it's called homophily. I think that's how you pronounce it. So if you've got curly hair, you're going to find somebody else. And if they don't have curly hair already, then they're probably going to get curly hair. But, you know, so this is how things spread. So a bit when Professor West was talking about emotional contagion, there's a science behind that. Things do spread contagiously, so curly hair spreads. The other rule about networks is, well, you're always going to find somebody else with the same sort of characteristics, and you like hanging around and, you know, you enjoy the same things, a knitting group. Sue belongs to a knitting group, so she finds other people who are interested in knitting to have a conversation with. But another rule of networks is that networks close naturally. So one of the things about working with communities is you need to make sure that you don't just let people have closed networks, that you kind of always try to open those networks up to bridge the kind of community capital between those different groups of people. But that's one of the rules of networks. But you can get this closed network. We're probably a closed network in here, all of people who believe in health coaching. And dynamic social networks basically spread like this. So you've got one person with an idea. So this is Penny. And then Penny gets a friend, Andrew, and they talk about health coaching, and they're going to make this happen. They're going to do all this training in the East of England. It's going to be fantastic. So they've got to get some other people involved. People got to pay. People got to sign up for the course, etc. And then they all meet each other, and suddenly you're a little group of people who are all really interested in, you know, getting health coaching off the ground. And then you've got other networks and other people that you communicate with. So this is how things spread within a network. So if you can imagine that you're all that hub, that dot in the middle, if you're all that hub, how could you create this network, this movement for change around health coaching, by talking about it and sharing it? And when we're talking about change, we're not talking about top-down change anymore. I mean, unless you've got a multi-million pound programme, you're just going to, you know, roll it out in your area. I doubt that anyone in here is in that position. But actually, the best way to spread change is to be thinking about your networks on the right and having people who might be at all different levels of a hierarchy within an organisation that can become champions for what you want to do. So you're kind of seeding it in lots and lots of different places. You'll still need a guiding coalition in the middle, but this is how you kind of like to think about it. You actually need the hierarchy and the network to make things happen, because that person at the top does control the money, don't they? I just wanted to mention about kind of like the spread of social movement. So this is the personalisation movement. You know, that came from a group of people saying, you know, we don't want to be in institutions anymore. We want to get out of long-stay hospitals and care in the community. And you actually got to change in government policy. You know, so a group of disabled people and people who are really, really passionate about changing the lives of older and disabled people. Actually, it became government policy in putting people first in the last Labour government. So, and it's still there, because the coalition became so big that everybody, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, thinks that self-directed support, care and support planning, person-centred approaches are the way to go. And you know, that's a huge, huge change that's happened in quite recent years. I think this health coaching movement can become part of that, and also kind of like grow and build on it. I've stuck in these extra slides. So if you've heard of 6 degrees of separation, that idea that, you know, you could actually be related to anybody by 6 degrees, that actually won't take you very much longer before you're all kind of, you've got 6 degrees between you and Barack Obama or whatever, I don't know. So anyway, this was the experiment that they actually, this citizen in Nebraska was asked to mail this letter to someone they thought would know a particular businessman in Boston. And it basically only required 6 steps for the letter to get to the right place, because somebody always knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody 6 times. So we're all kind of like connected to each other by 6 degrees of separation. And then there's something called the 3 degrees of influence. So I got all of this from the website connected to the Connected book. So this is Christakis and Fowler, if you want to look it up. So they found that influence dissipates through 3 degrees. So, for example, you're more likely to smoke if your friend's friend's friend smokes, even if you've never met them.
So actually, emotional contagion that Professor West was talking about, yeah, if you kind of are spreading compassion, even if you've never met that third person down the line, you are likely to create a more compassionate culture just by doing so. There is a science behind it. So, Krasakis and Fowler said, if we're connected to everybody by 6 degrees and we influence those up to 3 degrees, then we can reach halfway around the world. So the possibilities are endless. And this is a social network map, you know, a bit bigger than the one I showed you with the hub in the middle and all of the kind of like the joining parts. These are different people's social networks and the connections between them. So that's the Coalition for Collaborative Care. We're delighted to be working with Penny and hope that gives you a bit of thought going into your into a bit in the afternoon, which is about how you make the change, how you become part of this movement and how you lead things going forward. Thank you.